Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. The House Ag Committee Thursday discussed H.R. 3532, a bill to require the Secretary of Agriculture to carry out periodic wildfire assessment. Representative Jim Costa of California was a co-sponsor of the bill. He was among those who spoke at the meeting.
I want to thank Representative O'Halloran for this important legislation, of which I'm a co-sponsor. We had last year's subcommittee hearing that has the jurisdiction over the U.S. Forest Service, and had learned that the forest management plan has not been updated in a long time period. And I think this legislation would help really highlight the impacts, especially in the western states that have been devastated over the last 5 years with extreme drought conditions. Fire has been a constant. As a matter of fact, we say now in California that we no longer have a fire season, we have a fire year. And the impacts and lives lost and dislocation and the economic impacts have been in the billions and billions of dollars. And clearly we need to get a handle on this. This legislation would produce a report 2 years after the date of enactment and every 5 years thereafter, would detail direct and indirect costs of wildfires and who has the burden and the cost. Each report would be compared to the preceding report. The bottom line, in my view, is that for decades now, we've done a poor job in managing our forests. And this is not to point finger or to lay blame. It has run through a number of administrations, Republican and Democratic alike. We tend to put a lot of money in the Forest Service's budget to do fire suppression, a lot less money for forest management. The two are directly related. And I believe that if we did a better job in our forest management and address these impacts, as we learn a much better way to manage our forests, not only would we reduce the amount of fires that take place, we'd have an ability to control them to a much greater degree. And the University of California at Merced that I represent is doing some very innovative research. And in California, by the way, 61% of our forests is owned by the federal government. To that, when you reduce the growth and the brush, that we do a better job of maintaining our snowpack that translates into water that is used, especially during these extreme drought conditions. With excessive vegetation, that water is consumed and therefore it can't be used for the other more important purposes, in my view, which would be for human needs, for the other production of food and fiber, and also it would have an overall environmental benefit. So this legislation, were it to become law, would, I think, require the U.S. Forest Service to get a better handle on the needs between forest management and fire suppression and how we do a better job going forward. This is something that I think is not only in the interest in western states, but throughout the country. And so I therefore commend the author for his efforts on the legislation and support the bill wholeheartedly and ask for the committee for an aye vote. I yield back the balance of my time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Costa, and now I recognize myself for just a brief moment. This work by Mr. O'Halloran is very important. He's been at a very strong leadership position in on our western border to deal with these ravaging forest fires. And I commend him for his excellent work on that, and certainly appreciate the ranking member working with him. Mr. Ranking Member, do you wish to be recognized now to make a commitment of working on this bill with Mr. O'Halloran from Arizona?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Chairman. And I want to thank the gentleman from Arizona. I know we share a passion for proper, healthy forest management. And I appreciate his work on this bill. And it looks at a very comprehensive way, the analysis, and it looks at a lot of important things that I think we need to be tracking to help us to show the impact of these wildfires in a more, in a better light, so that not just those of us who make public policy decisions, but the general public understands the impact of these out-of-control wildfires. But we know, with the technical assistance from the Forest Service, identified a number of concerns that I think are opportunities. I look at them as opportunities that we can address. And although more wildfire data could be helpful in so many cases, this legislation needs more development and consultation with the Forest Service. And I absolutely commit to work with you, Mr. Chairman, and a gentleman from Arizona on this bill and other fronts moving forward to help our states and so many others. Much greater management is needed based on current data, especially given the testimony we received from the Biden administration Forest Service chief the other week. Our Republican members have introduced a number of thoughtful forestry proposals related to wildfire and active management. And along with consideration of this specific piece of legislation, I'd like to work with you on these additional proposals, seek technical assistance from the Forest Service, and really fully vet and develop each bill with the stakeholders. And so I look forward to working with you, Mr. O'Halloran. And Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Well, thank you, Ranking Member. I thank you for your comments. And the bill now, for now, is withdrawn.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to speak on the bill.
I think that's Mr. Lamalfa.
Who seeks recognition?
Lamalfa, California.
For what purpose does the gentleman wish to speak?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to speak for a moment on Mr. O'Halloran's bill.
The gentleman is recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll thank you to also Mr. O'Halloran for H.R. 3532. I think it's very important that the Forest Service documents indeed what are the costs of wildfire and general of the lands it's supposed to be taking care of. And so I would share frustration, I think, with the author. I don't want to speak for him, but I know this bill was introduced some time ago, and only yesterday do we get 6 points from the Forest Service talking about all the reasons it's going to be so difficult in order to have a cost accountability for wildfire and what the value of forest lands that are burned. And so I that frustrates me, because it looks more like excuses instead. One of the points is that it would require 100 people working full-time to figure out the cost of all wildfire and wildfire suppression. How in the world did they get 100 people into a building to figure out the cost of this? And if that's what it takes, then why don't they scale back to something that's a little closer to a good estimate? And on private concerns, it wouldn't be that difficult. And so, it's just like it's more of a way to say no towards the accountability that they should be having built in all along anyway, if they're going to be charged with taking care of these lands. So they talk about one of the points would be difficult in order to request the data from private individuals or private entities. So my understanding, maybe we could amend that part and have it not cover private, just, even though forest fires that start on Forest Service lands affect private people, maybe we can move that part out. So I just hear a lot of reasons why it's hard to do and can't be done. And that's really frustrating me, because they want to continue to be charged with taking care of these lands. So I'm frustrated by this, and I hope Mr. O'Halloran will continue with the bill in some effort in some form, and I look forward to working with him, my other colleagues that are co-sponsors on that, because we need that accountability, and it's just tired excuse one after another for why things can't be done and shouldn't be done. Maybe they shouldn't be in charge of so much responsibility with all the acres that they have in California and through the West, and have more stewardship processes that they could be partnering with others in order to take care of these lands. So, you know, I appreciate the effort by the author and being able to be a co-sponsor. And, you know, we got to do better and demand better. Otherwise, something needs to be radically different. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll yield back the remainder of my time.
Well, thank you very much. And we will be working with Mr. O'Halloran on this bill.
Following Costa, we heard from Committee Chairman David Scott of Georgia, followed by Representative Glenn Thompson of Pennsylvania and Representative Doug LaMalfa of California. We have more from the House Ag Committee in segments 3 and 4 today, including a bill to create a library for cattle contracts. That's coming up in segment 3. We'll be right back.
Network with the top tier of the industry at this year's California Trina Conference, featuring presentations from the top executives from CDFA and California's tree nut commodity boards. Register at WCNGG.com, and we'll see you in Tulare on November 3rd at the California Tree Nut Conference. Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. Does your crop have iron chlorosis? AgroPlante has a solution for you. Traditionally, chelated iron has limitations that AgroPlante's Iron Force does not. Iron Force, with its EDDHA chelation technology, can turn your plant's iron chlorosis from yellow to green in as little as 15 days, despite unbalanced soil pH and calcareous soils. From organic certified to conventional micronutrients, AgroPlante has the product for you. Call 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplante.com.
Welcome back. Here's your news for today. A coalition of more than 80 agricultural groups filed formal objections this week regarding EPA's rule to revoke all tolerances of the pesticide chlorpyrifos. Michael Clement shares what the rule means for agriculture.
A large coalition of agriculture groups wrote to the Environmental Protection Agency asking it to postpone revocation of chlorpyrifos until it can consider their formal objections to the rule. Allison Crittenden, American Farm Bureau Federation Congressional Relations Director, says the August 30th rule goes against EPA science.
We object to how EPA has come to this decision to revoke tolerances for chlorpyrifos. We make the case in the letter that EPA's own scientific record on chlorpyrifos shows that there are actually many safe and high benefit uses of this chemistry that do not pose a dietary or environmental risk. So in this letter, we're asking EPA to acknowledge that and to stay its decision to revoke these tolerances.
Crittenden says the EPA rule takes another tool out of the toolbox for farmers.
Chlorpyrifos is a really important product for very tailored uses. There are some crops like cherries and sugar beet where chlorpyrifos is really the only alternative to help with these different pest threats. It's also important in controlling aphids and soybeans. So what this means is we're losing, once again, another tool in the toolbox that was important to agriculture and to farmers.
Now, the coalition will wait for a response from the EPA.
Obviously, there's a very strong showing having over 80 agricultural groups signing on to this one coalition objection. I think now we see how EPA responds to this, and hopefully by explaining our concerns with the process in which this revocation was issued, we can prevent further activity in a similar vein for other pesticide products.
Michael Clements, Washington.
While traveling in Iowa this week, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack offered his support to striking John Deere workers. Visiting union members outside a Deere & Company plant in Iowa, the secretary told picketers, "You work hard and you deserve a fair price and fair deal," that according to Reuters. The Deere employees, represented by United Auto Workers, is joining thousands of others who've gone on strike in recent months. Precipitation is boosting the nation's topsoil moisture numbers in some areas. Stephanie Ho has more.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey has the latest look at topsoil moisture ratings.
This is the time of year you like to see topsoil moisture being reestablished or boosted by autumn rain and snow. And that's exactly what we're seeing in some areas of the country this fall.
He has the latest numbers for the week ending October 17th.
Very short to short ratings for topsoil moisture has improved fairly dramatically in recent weeks, currently standing at 37%. Just a few weeks ago, that number was as high as 50%. Just in the last week, we saw another 5 percentage point improvement. So last week, we were at 42%, very short to short.
The states with the highest shortages include Montana, Washington, and California.
On the flip side, a few areas are getting wetter. Surplus topsoil moisture stands at 9% nationally. That is a 2 percentage point increase from the previous week. Parts of the eastern Corn Belt into the Northeast have gotten fairly wet.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Supply chain disruptions and material shortages are fueling speculation about a herbicide shortage for the 2022 agriculture growing season. Alan Gray, the executive director of the Purdue University Center for Food and Agricultural Business, says flooding, COVID-19 outbreaks, and congested ports disrupted production and exports in China for months, resulting in chemical manufacturers rationing supply. Despite challenges related to the COVID-19 pandemic, a national recognition continues for some of the country's outstanding young farmers and their contributions to the farm and community. Rod Bain reports.
It has been a year of ceremonies where not one, but two classes were honored, due in part to the disruptions caused over the last year and a half from the COVID-19 pandemic. Graduation and commencement exercises, Hall of Fame induction events. However, for the 2021 National Outstanding Young Farmer recipients, their formal recognition will wait until this coming February. As last year,
we've decided to not hold our national convention for health reasons and safety reasons for all involved, but we are going to recognize the finalists. We are going to be bringing them to our 2022 convention, which will be held in Hilton Head. So we'll recognize two classes at that time.
Sharon Page of the National Outstanding Young Farmer says it's been a unique time period for her organization amid its long and unique history.
The National Outstanding Farmer was founded in 1955 by the U.S. Junior Chamber of Commerce, which are the JCs, one of recognized leadership in agriculture. In 2011, the alumni, which is a large group of past winners, took it over because the JCs asked us if we would, and we were very proud to do that.
Annually, 10 farmers, male, female, or couple, are recognized as finalists, attending the national convention in February, with 4 receiving the honor of National Outstanding Young Farmer. But what exactly constitutes the definition of young farmer for this organization?
They have to be 40 years and below. 2/3 of your income do have to come from farm operation. You don't have to be sole proprietor, but you do have to be one of the major proprietors.
And in terms of additional qualifications and characteristics that should apply to a National Outstanding Young Farmer candidate,
it doesn't matter how many acres you have, it's what you do with it. So we have some very creative individuals that have taken 15 acres per se, and they've used that 15 acres. They have greenhouses, they have markets. They've gone out to the neighborhoods and started like neighborhood farm fresh markets. They've gone into classrooms and taught. You have your dairy farmers, our big grain operations, but we've had grape growers, we've had fruit growers, we've had floral, and in all different aspects of agriculture.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
USDA's National Institute for Food and Agriculture recently invested $2 million for 7 awards for the Special Research Grants Program for Aquaculture. The grants support the development of new science-based information and technology for environmentally and economically sustainable aquaculture industries in the United States. The program seeks practical solutions that will facilitate growth of the U.S. aquaculture industry, reduce the U.S. trade deficit in seafood products, and enhance the capacity of the U.S. aquaculture industry to contribute to food security and economic growth. A lot of people are flunking the clean hands test, at least in the kitchen. Gary Crawford has more.
Most people may have missed this, but Friday, October the 15th, was Global Hand Washing Day. It was also my birthday. That about says it on that score, but maybe that bad fanfare should apply to our hand-washing efforts or lack thereof. The Agriculture Department has been doing several years of research studies on food safety, and so in this case they put people in test kitchens and had them prepare certain meals, and the researchers would then watch what goes on. In this case, watching to see if people are washing their hands every time they're supposed to, and if they're washing their hands the way they're supposed to for food safety. And the result?
Hand-washing is not anywhere near where we would hope it to be amongst consumers.
Certainly not. That's Meredith Carruthers with USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service. She says the study shows without a doubt when it comes to hand washing when preparing meals, almost all of us flunk the course.
We have found that participants are failing to properly clean their hands up to 99% of the time before and during meal preparation.
Well, now here's how the study was carried out. For a certain meal, food experts identified several spots along the way in the preparation and cooking process that hands should be washed to avoid any bacterial cross-contamination problems from raw meat and poultry onto other foods or plates or utensils and onto other surfaces in the test kitchen, and then off those surfaces and back to the meat and poultry products. Now, multiple apply the number of spots where hand washing is called for times the number of test participants, and in this particular case you get 1,003 hand washing events that should have happened. But
ultimately, of these 1,003 cases, hand washing was attempted only 5% of the time that it was required, and about 72% of participants attempted to wash their hands before beginning meal preparation, which is great. But among these hand washing attempts, only 5% of them contained the correct steps for hand washing and were considered successful.
And those steps for effective hand washing, according to the Centers for Disease Control, are
wet hands with water, rub hands with soap for at least 20 seconds, rinse hands with water, and dry hands using a clean one-use towel.
Which, as you heard, hardly anybody did all of that. Biggest mistake:
not rubbing hands with soap for 20 seconds.
As this little rap song goes:
wash them, rub them, and please make sure you scrub them.
But despite a lot of effort in trying to get people to do that, the studies so far show almost total rejection of good hand washing practices, at least in the studies so far. Now, these studies, though, were done pre-COVID. Meredith Carruthers says they're gearing up to do another study now that COVID's part of the picture,
to help determine how some of these behaviors have changed as a result.
Or if they've really changed at all, at least in America's kitchens. This is Dex. Okay, I'll wash my hands the right way. Just don't make me listen to this again. This is Gary Crawford. I'm washing my hands of the whole situation. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Make it stop.
That's our news for today. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Members of the House Ag Committee Thursday passed H.R. 5609, a bill to create a library for cattle contracts within the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Agricultural Marketing Service Department. Supporters of the legislation say cattlemen are currently unaware of contract terms offered by packers, leading to a decline in leverage for small producers during price negotiations. South Dakota Republican Dusty Johnson co-sponsored the bipartisan Cattle Contract Library Act of 2021. He spoke on behalf of the legislation during Thursday's markup.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the recognition and thank you for this markup. Any business person understands the importance of price discovery. It's a critically important part of any functioning market. And you can't have price discovery if you don't have transparency. Now, this transparency used to be real easy in the cattle market. Overwhelmingly, people took their cattle down to the sale barn. And boy, you want to talk about transparency. Everybody there can see exactly what the bids are. Now, as we've had sales move away from the sale barn, away from cash sale, and toward alternate marketing agreements, transparency has been harder to come by. And so what this bill does is it injects much-needed transparency back into this marketplace. So I think we should have high confidence that this is the right thing to do for two reasons. First off, the committee process works. We have vetted these ideas through two recent hearings before this committee. We have had a number of experts, including producers, who every single day go out in the field and work with the cattle and try to figure out how to market their cattle. And overwhelmingly, we have heard that this is an important step. We have heard those producers, and we have integrated their feedback into this concept. Number two, and I've talked about this a lot, but consensus has sometimes been hard to find in the livestock marketplace, but we have it here. A few months ago, the Livestock Marketing Group Association did a really good job in pulling together the key market players in Phoenix and telling them that they needed to reach consensus so that we could move forward to get good things done here in the policy arena. That group came away, that meeting came away with three priorities: additional transparency, more robust investigation, and additional capacity. And we're making progress in those areas, including number one, transparency. That group came out and endorsed those three arenas, including a cattle contract library that sits before this committee right now. And for people who say that this isn't a silver bullet, they are absolutely right. We are building, we've had a pretty good run, Mr. Chairman, ranking member. We have had Congresswoman Craig and I have leveled the playing field for small processors earlier this year. The administration took the key concepts that Abigail Spanberger and I had advanced in the Butcher Block Act. We are getting real things done, but the work is not done. The work needs to continue, but make no doubt about it, this is a consensus-based and a critically important step as we move forward. With that, I would reserve my time and stand by for any questions.
House Ag Committee Chair David Scott supported the bill.
I thank the gentleman, I do want to make a brief statement. I support this fine work by Mr. Johnson. As you all may remember, at our recent livestock hearing, it was very clear that few cattle market policies enjoy complete consensus. And one of the consensus is that we do not want livestock mandatory reporting to expire. And I have a bill, as many of you know, H.R. 5290, that takes care of extending this program for 1 year. Mr. Johnson's bill is very important, and I support it wholeheartedly. Without objection, the first reading of the bill is waived. And now, before we begin on amendments, if there are any, is there any other member that wishes to speak on Mr. Johnson's bill?
Democrat Angie Craig of Minnesota spoke on behalf of the legislation.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say thank you to my colleague, Mr. Johnson, and also Mr. Quaylar for leading this really important bill. You know, price transparency and discovery lead to greater competition. And of course, that helps farmers and ranchers across my district and across the country. This is just one piece of a larger puzzle that we must continue to address. And I look forward to these bipartisan conversations that will continue on the issue. I urge my colleagues to support this bill. I also just wanted to make a quick comment and thank my colleagues for supporting in advance the Chronic Wasting Disease Research and Management Act. I've long advocated for continued focus on this issue given the devastating impact of chronic wasting disease, and I appreciate the fact that stakeholders have come together to support this bill. Just wanted to give a shout out as well to Mr. Kind, who represents a district right across the Mississippi River from me, as well as to the ranking member for your leadership on it. So thank you so much for getting us together, Mr. Chairman, for such a bipartisan effort here this morning. And with that, I yield back.
Here's California Representative Jim Costa.
I move to strike the last word.
Mr. Gentleman, it's recognized. 5 minutes.
Seem to have a robust legislative agenda this morning, but I want to speak to support H.R. 5609. Ranking Member Johnson on the Subcommittee on Livestock that I have the honor to chair has been passionate, as you can tell from his comments, and very energetic in his efforts to work with the cattle and livestock industry in this nation. And I want to commend also Representative Craig for her efforts in trying to put together a bipartisan effort, which I think this legislation reflects. It goes, I think, hand in hand, Mr. Chairman, with your legislation, which is the clean reauthorization for 1 year. The livestock industry in the United States is dynamic. It's changing. And it has a lot of, challenges that we face, that we've learned certainly in the 20 months of a pandemic, a healthcare crisis that has literally, last year, as we've all noted, with the closure of schools and restaurants, turned a complex, complicated food supply chain upside down. And as a result of that, we have had dislocations in the market. We have had other impacts that we could never have foresaw or anticipated prior to the pandemic. And I think with good faith, and there have, I think, been some robust discussions that have taken place among competing interests. We need to allow folks to come together in ways that make sense. And I think that Representative Johnson has attempted to do that with this Contract Library Act and bringing parties together. I commend him for his efforts. The fact is that I hope we've learned some lessons as a result of this pandemic and our food supply chain, because again, it relates to my earlier comments, food is a national security issue. And the fact is that I think we need to continue to look on ways in which we can ensure that people in the cattle business, I have had family members that have been associated with it for decades, reflect the needs that a consuming public has in this country to ensure that we get the finest product available at effective costs, consumer costs, point costs, and that we ensure that that supply chain remains robust and competitive and transparent, as the representative indicated in his opening comments. Transparency, I think, is a critical factor in all of this. So we'll continue to work on this. We have other issues that are out there, and it's my intent, Mr. Chairman, to work with the ranking member of the subcommittee, not only in these two pieces of legislation, but as we move forward to work with all of the elements of the livestock industry in this country, making sure that everybody has a seat at the table and their voices are heard so that we can work in a constructive fashion. So with that said, I commend the author for his efforts, and I can commend the chairman for his 1 year reauthorization, clean reauthorization of the legislation that I will support. So with that said, I yield back the balance of my time, and I thank you very much.
The legislation passed the Ag Committee without objections.
H.R. 5609 is open for amendment at any point. Is any member wish to make an amendment? Hearing no further amendments, the question now occurs on reporting the bill favorably to the House. All those in favor of the bill say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. In the opinion of the chair, the ayes have it and the motion is agreed to.
The bill now goes to the full House. The legislation received broad support from the American Farm Bureau Federation, National Cattlemen's Beef Association, U.S. Cattlemen's Association, National Farmers Union, and the Livestock Marketing Association. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you. Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Welcome back. Continuing our coverage of the House Ag Committee, the committee Thursday passed legislation for scholarship funding at 1890s land-grant institutions. Here's Representative Jim Costa of California, who spoke on behalf of the legislation.
Denies for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move to strike the last word to speak on this very important piece of legislation, H.R. 4252, for 1890 universities in America. It's a reflection of your good work and the importance of this piece of legislation that we have the overwhelming bipartisan support to make this a permanent portion of efforts that America has done historically to invest in our infrastructure. And that's what I view this as, an investment in our infrastructure. We look at investments in different ways. A previous colleague mentioned the Mallory Act that President Lincoln signed in July 2nd, 1862. I only mention that because on July 1st, 1862, he signed the legislation to create the Transcontinental Railroad. Now, everybody understands the railroad as an investment in infrastructure, but the very next day, he committed America to investing in land-grant universities. This follows that tradition with the 1890 universities that, frankly, did not get the support that they should have received. And this is an effort to provide support that is fitting and appropriate for these universities across the country. Our colleague, Representative McGovern, indicated about the importance of food to the American family and hunger being a challenge that we face. I'd like to say, and you've heard me mention before, that food is a national security issue. It's a national security issue. the hard work that 4% more or less of the Americans that are directly engaged in the production of food and fiber every day make it possible to put food on America's dinner table. And these universities have such incredible opportunities if they're given the support. And these scholarships would provide the support to use that talent that Representative Bishop talked about, that tremendous amount of young people who are engaged and who want to have an opportunity to participate in one of the great successes of America, which is our ability to not only produce food for our entire country, but to produce more food than we can consume, and to use that as we provide for other parts of the world. And with climate change, I can tell you, as a third-generation farmer, that the challenges that we face today in America to continue that productivity, to provide nutritious, the most nutritious, advanced production of food and fiber. The fact is I'll close by saying that this legislation, to make it permanent, I think reflects a bipartisan commitment on this committee that we do the right thing. Because I think that, as I tell students, as we all visit our students, that we want them to do well, because guess what? They're our future. If they do well, our country does well. The opportunities for these scholarships for these students will allow them to participate in the 21st century on how we put that food and fiber, not only on America's dinner table, but with climate changes and the population of the planet adding another 2 billion people by the end of, or the middle of this century, that ability to produce food and fiber is a national security issue. These students, when they graduate and they pursue their careers in agricultural initiatives, will add to that value for our country and for the world. So it's a great piece of legislation, and I thank you for your good work.
That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.